KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And Wisconsin's stood up and said loudly that justice does not have a price. Our courts are not for sale.
Judge Susan Crawford wins a seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, defeating her Elon Musk-backed opponent. Musk spent over $25 million on the most expensive judicial race in U.S. history. We'll go to Wisconsin for the latest. Then Trump's escalating war on universities as he moves to cut more than $9 billion in federal funding to Harvard and Princeton. We'll look at the turmoil at Columbia University, which capitulated to demands from the Trump administration. We'll speak to former Columbia law professor Catherine Franke.
A lot of people have been calling me and saying, what the heck? What's going on at Columbia? We thought it was bad, but now it's worse. You've got another president? What's up with that? Well, I think it's fair to say that what we've seen is a coup. We've seen the trustees, the board of trustees, go rogue and put in one of their own people as the acting president in violation of the actual statutes of the university.
Plus, Trump's immigration crackdown is coming under increased criticism after the administration admits it mistakenly flew a Salvadoran father living with his family in Maryland with protected status to a mega prison complex in El Salvador. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israeli attacks killed at least 41 Palestinians over the past 24 hours as Israel's military announced a major new ground offensive. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said his forces will seize large areas of Gaza for so-called security zones. The announcement came as Palestinians face widespread food insecurity, with Israel's total blockade of the Gaza Strip continuing for a 31st day. On Tuesday, Gaza's residents were unable to find bread after all the territory's bakeries, including 25 run by the World Food Program, shut down operations.
I came here before dawn and went to all the bakeries in the area, but they were all closed. So I came back here in front of this bakery, hoping that God will bless us with bread. What can we do? Let them bring us flour and fuel. Why are they preventing us from getting them?
Hamas said in a statement, Gaza has reached a famine phase, calling it one of the worst humanitarian crises in modern history. An Israeli military agency that coordinates aid deliveries to Gaza wrote on social media Tuesday, quote, there is enough food for a long period of time if Hamas lets the civilians have it, unquote. A UN spokesperson was asked about that claim.
Israel says there's still enough food that was delivered to Gaza during the ceasefire. What is the UN's response to that?
As far as the UN is concerned, that's ridiculous. I mean, we are at the tail end of our supplies, of the UN, of the supplies that came in through the humanitarian route. You know, WFP doesn't close its bakeries for fun. If there's no flour, if there's no cooking gas, the bakeries cannot open.
UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric. Elsewhere in Gaza, The Guardian reports some of the bodies of 15 Palestinian paramedics and rescue workers killed by Israeli forces and buried in a mass grave last month in Gaza were found with their hands or legs tied and had gunshot wounds to the head and chest. The Trump administration says it'll deploy a second aircraft carrier, the USS Carl Vinson, to the Middle East amidst U.S. airstrikes on Yemen that have killed over 60 people since March 15th. Overnight, U.S. attacks reportedly killed at least four people in Yemen's Hodeidah region. In related news, the White House says it's moving on from the scandal in which National Security Advisor Mike Waltz mistakenly shared plans to attack Yemen over the commercial messaging app Signal with Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic.
As the president has made it very clear, Mike Waltz continues to be an important part of his national security team. And this case has been closed here at the White House as far as we are concerned. There have been steps made to ensure that something like that can obviously never happen again.
Meanwhile,
and we're moving forward.
Meanwhile, The Washington Post reports members of President Donald Trump's National Security Council, including Mike Waltz, have conducted government business over personal Gmail accounts and another apparent violation of security protocols and federal records laws. A federal judge has ruled in favor of Mahmoud Khalil, allowing the Palestinian Columbia University student protest leader to challenge his detention and deportation in a New Jersey court. The order is seen as a victory for Khalil, as this is the second time a federal judge has denied the Trump administration's request to transfer the case to the state of Louisiana, where Khalil has been held at an ICE jail for nearly a month. His legal team continues to fight for his release. In a statement, Khalil's wife, Dr. Noor Abdallah, said, quote, "This is an important step towards securing Mahmoud's freedom, but there is still a lot more to be done. As the countdown to our son's birth begins and I inch closer and closer to my due date, I will continue to strongly advocate for Mahmoud's freedom and for his safe return home so he can be by my side to welcome our first child," she said. Unions from across the United States gathered for peaceful actions Tuesday outside more than 10 ICE jails nationwide, protesting the Trump administration's targeting of immigrant university students and faculty. The Service Employees International Union condemned the abduction of two of its members, including Tufts University graduate student Rumeysa Öztürk, by masked federal agents in broad daylight earlier this month. Öztürk is a lawful visa holder from Turkey. This is SEIU President April Verrett.
What we know about Rumeysa, she holds a valid student visa. She also wrote an op-ed for her student newspaper not long ago in support of the Palestinian people, utilizing her First Amendment rights in this country to express her opinion, totally in keeping with the values that this country purports that it stands on. Yet, being taken away in handcuffs by men in masks and in hoodies. She's not the only SEIU member either. We know about our sister, Llewellyn, 64 years old, a lab tech in Washington State and member of Local 9-5. After living in this country 50 years, she's being detained by ICE.
In Germany, immigration authorities in Berlin are moving forward with the deportation of four young foreign residents over their involvement in Gaza solidarity protests. In a joint investigation, The Intercept and 972 magazine report the orders are set to take effect in less than a month. Three of the protesters are citizens of the European Union, while none have been convicted of any crimes. Their cases are drawing comparisons to the Trump administration's use of deportation to target Palestinian rights protesters. Republicans will hold on to their narrow majority in the House of Representatives after winning a pair of special elections in Florida Tuesday. In Florida's 6th congressional district, Republican State Senator Randy Fine has defeated Democrat and public school teacher Josh Weil to claim the seat vacated when Trump appointed Michael Waltz as national security advisor. Weil dramatically increased Democrats' share of the vote in a district Trump won by over 30 points last November. Meanwhile, Republican Jimmy Patronis has defeated Democrat Gay Valamont to win an open seat for Florida's 1st congressional district in the Florida Panhandle. Valamont's share of the vote increased by 10 percentage points over the November election when she lost to far-right Republican Matt Gaetz, who would later be nominated by Trump as attorney general, only to resign from Congress over sex trafficking and drug scandal. Patronis is Florida's chief financial officer. He previously called for public funds to be used to pay for Trump's legal defenses in his four criminal cases. In Wisconsin, liberal judge Susan Crawford defeated the Trump-backed candidate, Brett Schimmel on Tuesday to claim a pivotal Wisconsin Supreme Court seat, capping the most expensive judicial election in U.S. history. Crawford's election will have far-reaching impact on issues including abortion, voting rights, and congressional redistricting, which could change the balance of power in the U.S. House of Representatives, where Republicans hold a razor-thin majority. Judge Crawford overcame at least $25 million in spending by Elon Musk, the world's richest man, who told supporters at a town hall in Green Bay Sunday night that, quote, the entire destiny of humanity rested on electing Brad Schimmel. Crawford spoke to reporters after casting her ballot at a Madison polling station.
The involvement of Elon Musk specifically is something I did feel that I had to comment on, particularly when he started, you know, engaging in shenanigans like paying voters to sign petitions and giving away $1 million to, you know, obviously pre-selected people supporting my opponent. I don't think that's democratic for a billionaire to use his wealth in that way.
We'll go to Madison, Wisconsin after headlines to talk about Tuesday's elections in Wisconsin and Florida. The Trump administration fired about 10,000 federal health workers across the Department of Health and Human Services Tuesday, gutting agencies tasked with protecting the nation's food and drug supplies and safeguarding public health. The cuts will affect the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and several other health agencies. Overnight, entire research divisions and offices were eliminated. The White House says President Trump will unveil new tariffs on imported goods from a broad range of countries today, a date Trump has called Liberation Day. Ahead of Trump's announcement, Chinese state media reported leaders of Japan and South Korea had agreed to coordinate their response to any new tariffs with Beijing. Trump's trade war continues to rattle stock markets around the world. Over the weekend, the Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs raised its projected chance of a recession over the next year to 35%, up from its previous estimate of just 20%. New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker's broken the record for the longest speech ever delivered in the U.S. Senate. Booker's 25-hour protest of President Trump and his policies surpassed Strom Thurmond's 1957 filibuster in defense of Jim Crow. Beginning Monday evening, stretching until late Tuesday, Booker repeatedly warned of Trump's attack on Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, his economic policies, mass deportations, the power of billionaires like Elon Musk, and more.
John Lewis, so many heroes before us would say that this is the time to stand up, to speak up. This is the time to get in some good trouble, to get into necessary trouble. I can't allow this body to continue without doing something different, speaking out. The threats to American people and American democracy are grave and urgent, and we all must do more.
Again, that was the New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. The Trump administration's withholding tens of millions of dollars from 9 Planned Parenthood state affiliates that provide contraceptives and other vital reproductive health care, predominantly to low-income and people of color. The providers received notices this week stating their Title X funding was being temporarily retained due to possible violations of Trump's policies against diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI efforts. Health and Human Services has given the providers, which operate dozens of clinics nationwide, including in Indiana and Kentucky, 10 days to comply with Trump's demands to eliminate DEI initiatives. In a letter, HHS pointed to mission statements and other public documents that highlight the clinic's, quote, commitment to Black communities, unquote, as supposed evidence of their noncompliance. Meanwhile, in a victory for reproductive rights, a federal judge has ruled Alabama cannot criminally prosecute individuals or health care providers that help pregnant people to travel out of state to obtain abortions. Alabama has a total abortion ban with no exceptions for rape or incest. This all comes as the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments today in a case brought by South Carolina that seeks to expel Planned Parenthood clinics from its state Medicaid program. Those states are largely already prohibited from using Medicaid funds to provide abortions. Planned Parenthood says the move violates the Medicaid Act's free choice of provider provision. In more related news, the Trump administration's gutting USAID for reproductive health and family planning programs in dozens of global South nations. The move is expected to impact some 50 million women who will be cut off from contraceptive access. And federal prosecutors will seek the death penalty against Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old suspect in the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi made the announcement Tuesday, describing Thompson's killing as, quote, an act of political violence, unquote. Mangione's lawyer said in a statement, quote, the Justice Department's move from the dysfunctional to the barbaric, unquote. Upon his return to office, President Trump vowed to resume federal executions after they were halted by the Biden administration. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Wisconsin, where liberal Judge Susan Crawford defeated the Trump-backed Brad Schimmel for a seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court in the most expensive judicial election in U.S. history. Many view the race as a referendum on Elon Musk, the world's richest man and Trump mega donor, who's been heading the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle key federal agencies. Judge Crawford won 55% of the vote, even though Musk spent over $25 million on the race to help elect Schimmel. On Sunday night, Musk gave out $1 million checks to two Wisconsin voters, one of whom happened to be the chair of the Wisconsin Federation of Young Republicans. Judge Crawford made a reference to Musk during her victory speech.
As a little girl growing up in Chippewa Falls, I never could have imagined that I'd be taking on the richest man in the world. For justice in Wisconsin. And we won. And Wisconsins stood up and said loudly that justice does not have a price. Our courts are not for sale.
While Democrats are celebrating the results in Wisconsin, as expected, Republicans won two closely watched House races in conservative districts in Florida, but the races were much closer than in November. Joining us from Madison, Wisconsin is John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent. His new article headlined, Wisconsin Rejects Musk's Money, Trump's Lies, and the Right-Wing Assault on the Judiciary. And John, overall, I think it's being estimated that there was something like $100 million spent on the state judicial race. Can you talk about the significance of the liberal Judge Crawford's victory by quite a large margin?
It was quite a large margin, Amy. And let me tell you, I don't think we can overestimate the significance. Going into this race, when people would ask me about it, I would say there's no middle ground. If Crawford wins, it will be a huge signal that Americans are rejecting, obviously, the money that Elon Musk is using to try and buy elections, but also they're rejecting the direction of the Trump administration. On the other hand, if Brad Schimmel had won, it would have been taken by Trump and Musk as, you know, a total vindication for what they're doing. The reason that was so is because Wisconsin is an absolute battleground state. It's incredibly closely divided. In the last seven elections, five for president of the United States, five have been decided by under 30,000 votes. So this is a state where things are usually very, very close, but it wasn't that way on Tuesday. Susan Crawford did win by the better part of 200,000 votes. She did win that 55-45 victory. And what's perhaps most significant is she won communities and regions of the state that had voted for Trump just 5 months ago in a very, very high turnout election. So as I suggest, I just don't think you can overestimate the significance. This is a huge signal from a battleground state that Americans are genuinely upset, genuinely angry, I think, with Trump and with Musk.
And John, that wasn't the only race in Wisconsin. There was also an election for state superintendent of public instruction. What happened there?
Well, you're exactly right, Juan. And the race for superintendent of public instruction, which is the state's top education job, and is a very significant job. It's the post that current governor Tony Evers held before he became governor, was intensely fought. It was a battle between the incumbent, Jill Underle, who has been an absolute supporter of public education. She's a former rural educator, versus a woman named Brittany Kinzer, who was supported by the Republicans and who was supported by advocates for voucher programs that would take money out of public education. Very clear choice. Kinzer had a lot of resources. She was backed by a lot of the same campaigners that were out there for Brad Schimmel in the Supreme Court race. And Jill Underle won. It wasn't quite as big a victory as the Supreme Court race, but it was roughly a 53-47 victory, a very clear, solid win. So in both statewide races, in the battleground state of Wisconsin, the clearly progressive candidates won.
And John, could you comment on the results in the two congressional special elections in Florida?
Sure. Those are important elections because, you know, special elections in the first weeks of a new president's term often give us an indication of, you know, kind of where sentiment is going. Now, these were heavily gerrymandered districts. They were designed to elect Republicans. There was no question of that. And the prospect that a Democrat would actually win one of these seats was pretty hopeful on the part of any Democrat who thought that would happen. However, there was a huge shift in both of the Florida districts toward the Democratic candidates. Both of whom, by the way, were not, you know, famous people per se or, you know, particularly powerful figures. And they were running against very prominent officials in Florida on the Republican side. And yet what we saw is that counties in rural and more urban Florida that had actually been, you know, pretty supportive of Trump, in some cases shifted toward the Democrats. And overall, it was a result that I think Democrats can point to and do a sophisticated analysis. Essentially, what they need to say is this. Look, these weren't districts that we were going to win, but these are districts where you could get a measure of where the sentiment is moving in the United States. And that's what I would say. Remember, we have a lot of congressional districts across the U.S. that Republicans hold, but that are much, much more closely divided. It would be an easier run for the Democrat. So if you see this kind of shift in districts across the country in 2026, there's simply no question that the Democrats would take the House of Representatives.
So, again, those were two special elections in Florida for the seats of the embattled National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and for Gates, who was named as Attorney General, nominated by Trump, but then ultimately had to pull out of Congress around various drug and sex scandals. But I wanted to go back to Wisconsin for 1 minute and ask not only the significance for the country. I mean, if you take what Elon Musk said, he said it's for the future of Western civilization, but his candidate was defeated. But what this means, for example, in particular about abortion rights, as the Democrats keep the majority on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, John.
Sure. In Wisconsin, it was a very, very clear choice. Susan Crawford has been a very strong supporter of abortion rights for a long time. She, in addition to being in the past a lawyer for labor unions, she was a lawyer in cases brought by Planned Parenthood. And so there was no question of where she stood on the issue, and she put it front and center in her campaign. On the other hand, Brad Schimmel is a longtime Republican politician who'd been very closely associated with the anti-choice position and, in fact, was backed by ardent advocates of a ban on abortion rights. And so the choice couldn't have been clearer. And I think that there are always people who like to tell you that abortion is fading as an issue, that as time passes, you know, perhaps it's not as resonant. But when I was talking to voters yesterday, I was struck by the very strong turnout of young voters. I was at a polling place on the University of Wisconsin campus shortly before the polls closed, and there were literally young women running in to cast their vote, trying to make it in time, you know, before the closing of the polls. And in talking to these folks, you found a number of them were putting the issue of abortion rights very high on their list. So I think it continues to be a very resonant issue.
To ask you about all this money that Elon Musk is pouring into these political campaigns. I mean, talk about taking Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, putting it on steroids. Your sense of the legality of all of this, of offering $1 million to particular voters?
Sure. This Musk spending and the way he did his spending has been incredibly controversial in Wisconsin. The attorney general did bring an action against him. Other legal groups have been, you know, raising this issue. It didn't get litigated before the election, but I don't think there's any question that there's going to be a continuing examination of how Musk spent his money and of real questions of whether there were violations of Wisconsin election law. But there's something deeper as regards all this one. Even if it was legal, what we need to understand is that we had a situation in Wisconsin where the wealthiest man in the world tried to buy an election. He poured his money in as roughly $25 million in addition to all these other gimmicks, all these other stunts. And I think that a lot of political analysts would have told you, well, that's going to win because money wins in politics. But that didn't happen in Wisconsin. So when we talk about the significance of this, beyond the legalities, there's a political significance. The message out of Wisconsin is that Musk's money doesn't win. And that message matters for Democrats, obviously, going in to the 2025 fall elections, as well as the 2026 midterm elections. It also matters for Republicans in Congress, because there's no question Elon Musk has tried to intimidate them by threatening to use his money to punish any Republican that stands up to Donald Trump's agenda. Well, now those Republicans have a counter narrative, another piece of information which says that, yeah, maybe Musk's money could protect you in a primary, but it might not be enough to protect you in a general election. And so we've got a very significant signal out of Wisconsin about money in politics in general and about Elon Musk's money in particular.
I mean, it is remarkable that one of Elon Musk's $1 million recipients went to the chairman of the Wisconsin College Republicans, a person who had worked for Ron Johnson to get him elected, and in the fall of 2024 worked as for Turning Point Action, Charlie Kirk's group. But I want to turn to Texas for 1 minute as we wrap up. In an interview with the New York Times, Democratic House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries accused Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott of slow walking a special election to replace Congressmember Sylvester Turner in Houston, who died last month. This is really significant. I mean, it looks like Abbott is not going to call a special election, at least at this point, but will keep it open, this seat, which would most likely go to a Democrat representing Houston, of course, until the November 2026 election. We just have 30 seconds.
Sure. I've written about these issues a lot in the past. Governors playing with special election dates. It is an absolute assault on democracy. We need to understand that congressional seats, House seats, are filled in elections. They aren't appointed. And so when you have a governor of one party saying, we're not going to let people elect a successor to a member who has passed away, that governor is saying that I'm going to leave you, the people of a major American city, unrepresented for the better part of a year and a half. It is absolutely unacceptable, and Texans should be raising an outcry about what Governor Abbott appears to be doing.
John Nichols, we thank you for being with us, the nation's national affairs correspondent. We'll link to your various articles at democracynow.org. Coming up, Trump's escalating war on universities. Stay with us. People everywhere still alive by Krungbin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Princeton has become the latest university to be targeted by the Trump administration. The federal government's pausing dozens of federal grants to Princeton. The news came a day after the Trump administration threatened to cut off nearly $9 billion to Harvard over the school's response to student-led campus protests in solidarity with Gaza. Earlier, the Trump administration had suspended $175 million in federal funding to the University of Pennsylvania and $400 million to Columbia University. At Columbia, the Board of Trustees responded by agreeing to a series of demands from President Trump in an effort to keep the federal funding. This all comes as Columbia is in a state of turmoil. On Friday, Columbia's interim president, Katrina Armstrong, resigned as president. Columbia's Board of Trustees then elevated its own board co-chair, Claire Shipman, the journalist, to become the school's new interim president. Meanwhile, Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian Columbia student protest leader, remains locked up in an immigration jail in Louisiana more than 3 weeks after he was abducted by ICE agents at his Columbia University housing, after appealing to the president of Columbia to help him. On Tuesday, a federal judge in New Jersey ruled Khalil's lawsuit should move forward to New Jersey, where Khalil was taken before being sent to Louisiana. We're joined now by Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School. Welcome back to Democracy Now! So how unusual is it? I mean, this is now the third woman, the first three women to be president of Columbia University. First it was Manoush Shafiq, and now Katrina Armstrong being fired and replaced by the board co-chair, the Board of Trustees co-chair?
Well, what we're seeing is a continuation and an escalation of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University basically going rogue. There was also a report issued yesterday by the Columbia University Senate, almost 400-page report documenting the ways in which the trustees abused their power over the last 2 years in mismanaging events at Columbia. So Claire Shipman being appointed outside of the normal process, president at Columbia, is part of that pattern of really a takeover of the university by the trustees, by these corporate officers of the university who quite clearly have demonstrated that they do not feel any fidelity to protecting our academic mission, but in a way are working hand in glove with the Trump administration to destroy that very mission.
And Catherine, would you say the board is going rogue? What would be the normal process for the selection of a president at Columbia?
Well, Juan, I'm glad you asked. I brought Columbia's charters and statutes with me, and one section within there very clearly says that where a president or an acting president has stepped down, resigned or otherwise stepped down from office, the provost is supposed to become the acting president until such time as the trustees conduct a regular search that would involve many stakeholders in the university community. But instead of allowing Angela Olinto, who is the provost of Columbia, who I think is widely well regarded and I think would have been welcomed as an acting president by everyone in our community, instead of that, following the rules of the statutes, they appointed their own co-chair of the Board of Trustees. And Juan, I have to say, it feels like Columbia University has become the Tesla of the U.S. academic community, where wealthy people buy their way onto the Board of Trustees and then appoint themselves CEO of the organization, only to ruin the brand of that institution. No one in their right mind wants a Tesla right now. And people are heading for the doors at Columbia. The admissions just went out for the undergraduate program, and the numbers are way down. Students don't want to come to Columbia. So it feels very similar that we had this kind of hostile takeover of our institution, the one that you've had a long legacy with, Juan, that mirrors what's happening in other parts of the country as well.
And I wanted to ask you about this, the Trump administration's threat to cut off $400 million in federal funding to the university that forced it to back down on some key issues. Colombia has, by my last reading, a $14.8 billion endowment. It could easily have replaced that $400 million for the four years of the Trump administration from its own endowment, which I suspect that's what endowment is for emergency situations. What is your sense of how these universities over the last decades, by depending largely on either corporate donors or federal grants, have put themselves in a bind where they're basically under control by outside forces?
Well, I think that's exactly right, that the business model of a university, particularly large research universities like Columbia, is one that has come over the last many years to depend so heavily on federal money for its budget. It's the largest part of our budget, that along with the fees and other income we get from running the medical school. It's not tuition, it's not major donors, it's those two, the federal money and the medical school income. And when we are in alignment with the U.S. government, that's a great thing. But when we're not, we're incredibly vulnerable. And so I think this is a moment where all universities and higher education more generally needs to have a kind of reckoning of a new kind of business model of how to run a university that isn't so incredibly dependent upon shifts in the political winds in our country. Now, I don't actually think that the endowment is going to save our problem. Much of those funds in Columbia's endowment, which is the smallest endowment of all of the Ivy League schools, I'll note, are tied up in ways where they have to be allocated to particular funding streams. They can't just be reappropriated to fund or replace those federal grants. And it, in any event, would be a short-term Band-Aid. There's too much of the budget to cover with these federal grants that have been pulled. It's $400 million-plus dollars now, but it'll be a lot more. You look at Harvard, they're talking about billions of dollars. The endowment can't possibly fill that gap. So it's time for us to think about things like, why are faculty, or more importantly, university presidents paid so much? We need to think about who gets paid and valued within the university. It is those very researchers in the medical school who make many times more in salary from a philosophy professor or an English professor at Columbia, in part as a reward for the fact that they've been drawing these federal funds to underwrite the university's business model. So it's time for us to step back and not say, oh, the piggy bank is going to save us, but actually think more critically about how we run our universities.
I wanted to turn to Jeff Sovereign. He's one of the four children of Columbia University's first Jewish president, Michael Sovereign. On Tuesday, Democracy Now! Reached Jeff and asked him to read out loud the open letter he and his siblings just published in the Washington Post.
Our father, Michael I. Sovereign, was the first Jewish president of Columbia University, which he served for more than 60 years. We believe that if he were alive today, he would be disgusted by the government's coercion of Columbia, purportedly in the name of our religion. We don't believe that President Donald Trump is sincere about protecting Jews from anti-Semitism. We find it more likely that an administration whose vice president has agreed with Richard M. Nixon that professors are the enemy is using anti-Semitism as a pretext to damage Columbia and America's other elite universities. Our father is one of only three people interred on his beloved Columbia campus. Trump's attack on the university desecrates a place our family holds sacred. It is both plausible and disturbing that some at Columbia are anti-Semitic. But we do not believe attempts to force the university to relinquish its independence are an appropriate response. And we wish the Trump administration would stop gaslighting us all.
Again, that is Jeff Sovereign, one of the four children of Columbia University's first Jewish president, Michael Sovereign. He was reading from an open letter he and his siblings had published in the Washington Post. Professor Catherine Franke, you taught at Columbia for close to a quarter of a century. You ultimately were forced to retire around your support for pro-Palestinian students, Jewish students, Muslim students, students who consider themselves atheists, whatever, but who all share their concern about Israel's assault on Gaza. Can you talk about what he's saying and this hammer of accusations of anti-Semitism, equating them with anti-Zionism?
Well, Michael Sovereign was an incredible president of our university, and his office, after he stepped down from being president, was down the hall from me, so I saw him daily. He led the university through very difficult times and actually was president when I was an undergraduate at Columbia, at Barnard. Columbia didn't admit women at the point that I was an undergrad. And so his children's statement resonates so strongly with those of us who knew President Sovereign very well. I know that Lee Bollinger, our most recent, well, not most recent president, because we've had so many, but our most recent long-term president, is also finally expressing real concerns about the leadership at the university. And I've spoken to a number of the former provosts who feel that Columbia has lost its way in the name of protecting Jewish students, some Jewish students, from bias. And of course, we shouldn't have any form of anti-Semitism on our campus, but this is being used as a fig leaf for a political project. If Columbia really cared about eradicating all forms of bias from our university, then Columbia would have done something seriously about one of my male colleagues at the law school who uses the N-word in class regularly, a white male colleague who thinks that's funny and makes him cool, or another who tells slavery jokes to black students in the classroom. And thinks that's a very funny and appropriate thing to do in the classroom. And the black students in those classes brought complaints to the administration and nothing happened. So we have an overreaction in the case of anti-Semitism. And again, I don't want to say that there aren't any incidents. There always are forms of anti-Semitism in all the institutions we're part of. But we have actually no reaction to issues of sexism, racism, homophobia, et cetera. In fact, they've taken all that language down off the university's website at this point. I have trans colleagues at Columbia who are afraid for their own safety in the law school building. So the environment is not one that has made any of us feel safer. It is one in which our safety has been weaponized in the name of advancing this larger political project, which is ultimately, I think, about dismantling the very university itself.
And Catherine, I wanted to ask you about the Trump administration's campaign of terror, really, against international students, revoking immigration statuses. The Times of India reports that the State Department has emailed hundreds of international students asking them to self-deport for allegedly participating in campus activism. The United States has long been a place where students from all around the world come to study here. What's the impact of this on not just Columbia, but all universities across the country?
Well, Juan, I can't overstate how terrified our students are. And it's not just the students who are on visas or even green cards. It's all of our students who come from other countries who may even be citizens at this point, because it seems there's no limit to the ways in which this administration is going to both test and violate the law in cleansing. It feels like a kind of racial and ethnic cleansing that is happening on our campuses. One of the reasons I loved being a Columbia professor was that in many of my classes, half of the students came from other countries. They brought their experiences, their wisdom, other notions of other legal systems, other cultures into the classroom, and it made it such a rich learning environment. I learned so much from them. And when I talk to my colleagues now, I'm not teaching anymore, but I'm hearing that those students are not saying a word. And some of them are not even coming onto campus anymore because they're afraid of getting nabbed and of having the administration actually turn over their cell phones and home addresses. So the classes are actually being emptied of those voices and of those bodies. And it's a loss for the Columbia community, but it's a horrible form of terror for the actual students who are so frightened.
As we talk about what's happening to students, I wanted to end. We only have about a minute. On Tuesday, a federal judge in New Jersey ruled that Mahmoud Khalil, he was the negotiator between the students and Columbia University, he was a grad student at SEPA, who had a green card, that his case, he was taken from Columbia University housing, his green card was revoked, taken away from his wife, who is about to give birth, and sent to a Louisiana ICE jail. The judge in New Jersey ruled his case should move forward in New Jersey, where he was taken before being sent to Louisiana. What's happening in this case? You were an advisor to Mahmoud Khalil.
I worked very closely with him for, you know, a year and a half, as did the university. They picked him as the student that they wanted to sit in the middle between the students that were protesting and the administration itself, because they knew he was mature, he was reasonable, everyone trusted him. He was the exactly right person to be the negotiator between the university and the students. And then they put a target on his back, essentially, by allowing untruths to circulate in social media and elsewhere, to come out of the mouth of the Secretary of State and other Trump administration officials. You know, it just breaks my heart, Amy, to see what's happening to him and his family, but not only them. He is still in that detention center, that horrible place in Louisiana, even though the case is in New Jersey. And his lawyers are fighting very hard, I know all of them well, to get him moved. His case has been moved, but he has not been moved. And they're still making arguments to the judge to bring Mahmoud home so that he'll be home-ish in New Jersey, so that he'll be closer to his family and to his lawyers. It is a horrendous object lesson of how the institutions that you think you're part of and can trust turn on you, whether it's Columbia or the United States government, and how hard it is to then bring him back to a place of security and freedom. And we're all just hoping that these next arguments in court will bring Mahmoud back at least to a detention center in New Jersey, which is better than where he is now.
Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School. She was there for a quarter of a century. Forced to retire in January. Coming up, Trump's immigration crackdown coming under increased criticism as the administration admits it flew a Salvadorian father, a Maryland father, with protected status to a prison in El Salvador. Back in 20 seconds. My son. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how the Trump administration's transferred another group of immigrants to a supermax mega prison complex in El Salvador. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Monday 17 immigrants from Venezuela and El Salvador accused of being gang members have been sent to the Salvadoran mega prison Sunday after previously being detained at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Since Trump took office, the U.S. has expelled hundreds of immigrants and asylum seekers to El Salvador without due process, accusing many of belonging to gangs largely on the basis of having tattoos. One Venezuelan asylum seeker now held in the Salvadoran prison was removed for tattoos on each forearm that read Mom and Dad. This week, the U.S. admitted in a court filing that a Salvadoran dad with protected status was also among the hundreds of immigrants who were transferred to El Salvador. He was living with his family in Maryland. Kilmar Armando Abrego had been granted protected status in 2019, blocking the federal government from sending him back to El Salvador after he fled gang violence there. The Trump administration said Garcia was removed, quote, because of an administrative error, and that though it could not bring him back because it's now in custody of, he's in custody of El Salvador. Conservatives like MAGA podcaster Joe Rogan are also joining and speaking out against the removal of a professional makeup artist accused of being a gang member, calling the case horrific.
You got to get scared that people who are not criminals are getting, like, lassoed up and deported and sent to, like, El Salvador prisons. Mm. This is kind of crazy that could be possible. That's horrific, and that's, again, that's bad for the cause. Like, the cause is, let's get the gang members out. Everybody agrees. But let's not, innocent gay hairdressers get lumped up with the gangs, and then, like, how long before that guy can get out? Like, can we figure out how to get him out?
This comes as U.S. District Judge Edward Chen in San Francisco has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to end deportation relief and work permits for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants with temporary protected status. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Aaron Reichlin Melnick, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us again. Can you explain what is happening right now? Talk about the Maryland dad from El Salvador who was just deported to this human rights abusing mega prison. The administration is paying Bukele, the president of El Salvador, millions to hold these immigrants and asylum seekers.
Yeah, so on March 15th, the Trump administration sent three planes full of people to El Salvador with people they claimed were members of MS-13 or the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. The problem is, every single day now, new stories are coming out showing they made a lot of mistakes. And over the weekend, we found out for the first time that they made a mistake that they are admitting. And that was the deportation of a Maryland dad, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was sent there despite the fact that an immigration judge in 2019 ruled that he had protection from being deported to El Salvador. It was illegal to send him to El Salvador. And so now the Trump administration has had to admit they made a mistake there. But more and more evidence suggests this was a rushed operation where they shoved as many people onto those planes as they could that had been entered in a database somewhere as Tren de Aragua, and they never really bothered to check whether or not that was true. They just looked at people's tattoos and said, well, you know, we have an intelligence report that says people from Tren de Aragua have tattoos with crowns on them. So any person who has a crown on their body that's tattooed is a Tren de Aragua member. We don't need to go any further than that. And that's basically the level of due process people got. They weren't even told that they were being sent there, though. New stories coming out today confirms every person who was sent there was lied to and told that they were going to be deported to Venezuela. And they didn't find out till they landed in El Salvador what had actually happened.
Well, Aaron, even after the admission of the administration in terms of Abrego Garcia's case, Vice President J.D. Vance posted on the social media platform X that he was a convicted MS-13 gang member with no legal right to be here. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's just simply false. I'll take each one of those in turn. Convicted. He's not been convicted of anything. Mr. Abrego Garcia arrived here in 2011 as a 16-year-old fleeing the gangs himself, who had threatened to kill him if he didn't join them. He, like many thousands of youth that left El Salvador in that period, came to the United States seeking safety. And for the last 14 years has not gotten into any serious trouble with the law at all. He's been convicted of nothing. But what happened is in 2019, he was looking for day labor outside of a Home Depot in Maryland, and local cops arrested him and three other men there. Those local cops interrogated him, demanded to know whether he was connected to a gang. He denied it continuously. And then a local police detective wrote on a gang worksheet that a confidential informant had allegedly claimed that this guy was a member of a gang, a part of MS-13 that operated in Long Island. Mr. Abrego Garcia has never lived in Long Island, and he said this is ridiculous. And when his lawyers in 2019 tried to reach back out to the police to talk to the detective and say, hey, why did you put this down here? They found out that the detective had been suspended and the local police didn't even have a record of his arrest. So that is the only evidence that the government has ever offered that he is connected to MS-13. And despite that arrest, which did not lead to charges, he has never been charged or convicted of a crime once in his life. He also did win protection. In 2019, that arrest led to him being sent to ICE detention. He was locked in ICE detention for almost a year, and at the end, a judge granted him a protection known as withholding of removal that said, you are more likely than not to be persecuted if sent to El Salvador. So the one thing the government cannot do is deport you to El Salvador. And that's exactly what happened on March 15th.
But you recently testified in front of the Committee on Homeland Security, the Subcommittee on Border Security Enforcement, that Trump's diversion of thousands of law enforcement officers to mass deportation is actually creating a greater national security risk. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so the most important thing that people need to know about what the Trump administration doing, well, one of the most important things is that they have turned the entire U.S. federal law enforcement apparatus into an immigration enforcement apparatus. President Trump has diverted thousands of federal law enforcement officers away from their normal duties and told them to go carry out immigration arrests instead. One in four DEA agents that normally are out there tracking down drug rings are now involved in immigration enforcement instead. 80% of ATF investigators are now doing immigration enforcement. They've taken people from the IRS who are specialized in investigating financial crimes, and they're doing immigration enforcement. And even troublingly, they're taking the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force and making them do immigration enforcement, and Homeland Security investigations, where investigators have the job of protecting children from sexual predators online. Those people have been taken off of their duties of going after pedophiles and have been told that they have to do immigration enforcement instead. None of that is making the country safer. It's just transforming the entire country into a dragnet for immigrants while letting a lot of other people doing some pretty bad things off the hook.
Let me ask you about the U.S. District Judge Edward Chen in San Francisco temporarily blocking the Trump administration's efforts to end deportation relief and work permits for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants and TPS. With TPS, a third of a million have TPS. They could face mass deportation. In his ruling, the judge said that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's move to terminate TPS for Venezuelans will, quote, inflict irreparable harm on hundreds of thousands of persons whose lives, families, livelihoods will be severely disrupted, cost the U.S. billions in economic activity, and injure public health and safety in communities throughout the United States. The significance of this in this minute we have left, Aaron.
It's enormous. There was potentially 350,000 people were going to lose their job on April 7th. And another 300,000 in September, and then potentially 500,000 Haitians coming up this fall as well. And what Judge Chen ruled is if you want to terminate TPS, you've got to go through the right procedures, and you can't do it based on false claims that hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans are all tren de Aragua criminals when the status is only available to people with no criminal record.
What do you think in terms of the numbers that the Trump administration is claiming, more than 100,000 people deported so far in his administration?
Yeah, those numbers seem likely incorrect. They don't fit. The Trump administration said yesterday they'd also done 110,000 arrests already. That suggests they did 70,000 arrests in the last 2 weeks. I think somebody in the administration made a mistake. But what we know is these are the numbers they want. Their goal is to ramp up deportations and arrests as quickly as they can. And if that leads to a bunch of innocent people getting swept up alongside, the message that the White House is sending is they don't care. As long as they hit their numbers, who cares who's on those planes? They just want to get them out of the country.
Federal judges ordered the Trump administration to restore funds to programs that provide legal services to unaccompanied minors, to children in immigration proceedings. 10 seconds.
Great news. Children need lawyers. No child should have to face deportation in court alone. And the Trump administration wanted to strip away federally funded lawyers that Congress set aside money for.
We're going to leave it there. Aaron Reichlin Melnick, senior fellow.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.